Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello. Ian, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here. Hugo?
How are you?
Yep. Going well?
Online, yep. All right, did you?
Yeah, no, it was very quick and smooth.
Yeah, it is.
We just have to translate fine. The English, though. But from the American lady.
Yeah. Pound.
Yeah, pound. Okay. Yeah. No, that sounds all right.
That's good. How's your seeds for the cover crop going? Your seeds you've been buying for cover crops.
Yeah, no, we're getting rain today, and we planted two weeks ago. And
yeah.
So we watered last week, so with this rain on it now, we should start to get some germination.
Right. And you're planting a legume as well, aren't you?
We planted 12 different varieties.
12? And this is
grasses,
like...
grasses and legumes.
This is for winter cropping, is it? For winter?
Well,
or...
I'm just going to see how it performs. I might even leave it for the whole season and look at spring planting.
Yeah.
So it'll grow over the winter time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we won't be able to do that crop rolling because of there's so many different species in there. They won't
won't be able to do the what?
Where they come in with the roller crimpers.
Oh, yeah.
Because all your crop has to be at the one maturity level.
Gotcha.
And because we've got so many different species in there, they won't mature at the same time.
Oh,
so
okay.
We'll either have to plough it in or work it in, not plough it in, work it in or spray it off with herbicide.
Yeah. Hope not.
But anyway, it's a start. We've got to start learning about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're in. Yeah. As these other cash crops come out, we'll be sowing those down to green manure mixes and cover crop species too. So.
Yeah. You still grow poppies?
We're still growing poppies, yep.
Yeah.
They're just drying off now, or were drying off before the rain came.
Because you're after a fair bit of oil, aren't you?
That's for the alkaloid content, yep.
Oh, yeah, whatever that word was.
Yep.
Alkaloid, is it?
Alkaloid.
Alkaloid, right.
Yep. Morphine.
Right, good. Help all the people who need that sort of thing.
Yep. So they're just drying off now, so they'll be about 3 weeks from harvest.
I'll just put the phone down for 10 seconds. I just want to synchronise my watch to that of my... just want to turn the watch dial to that of the phone. Can you
yep,
just wait
sure.
10 seconds?
Yep.
Finding a bit. There's a couple of, my phone is my watch is a couple of minutes out, and I thought I didn't want to get confused as time goes on.
Yep.
It's all good. Okay. What's this, Helen? Right. Helen says the time's on the computer. How's that?
Tell you, time's on. Yep. I've got 12:27. Is that about right?
12:26. Just turned 12:27. Yep.
27. I suppose I could turn my mobile off in case it goes through.
Whatever you like. Turn off when the time comes.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to thank you for getting on the line. And when we finish the call, I'll give you another call, and then we'll have a bit of a chat as to what you're doing on the weekend and with Matt and that sort of thing.
Yep,
The satellite part, anyway.
Yep, sure. Yeah, so we'll actually finish the conversation and hang up, and then just go back on.
Yeah,
the normal conversation. Another call after that. Yep. Listen to the last one when we did. You did it with Tony Evans and Elaine on that hookup sort of thing.
Yep.
While Tony was still on the phone saying, "Anyone there? Anyone there?" when everyone had hung up.
Yeah, we. Yeah, no, don't know. That was a peculiar one because we want to keep talking to Elaine,
yep.
And Elaine wanted to talk to us, and we had a couple of guests who didn't get off the phone. They just sort of stayed on there, and Elaine was starting talking about sort of personal things, a bit more personal than general information, and I didn't know whether she wanted that sort of information to go out, but anyway, that's it all. It didn't matter. Didn't really matter.
I think Tony hung up soon after that, but he wondered where everyone got to.
Yeah. We try to keep it to about the 1 hour.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's easier to put. So we can put on the one CD. Otherwise, if it goes much more than an hour, we have to put two CDs, get two CDs going.
That's fair enough. Yeah. And usually about an hour's enough for people to take in.
Yeah, and hopefully we don't have to do too much editing. Actually, that's a good thing. We prefer not to use brand names like, Roundup and that sort of thing, or company names.
Just stick to the glyphosates and all
that. You have to use them, fair enough, but we don't want comebacks from some institutes sort of saying you've used our name incorrectly or that sort of thing.
That's right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Alright, well, we're pretty close. We've got about a minute to go, and I'll just introduce myself, and then I'll ask you to introduce you rather than me trying to create a story about you.
Yep.
So we've got no one else online at this stage, which is interesting. Last time we had about 8 or so people online. Every now and then we get to know one comes online. It's too busy or holidaying or whatever.
Yep.
Anyway, time is right, so we're going to get going, all right?
Sure, okay. Sounds good.
Right. I'm Hugo Disler, and I've got the pleasure of having Ian Smith online. Ian, I'd like you to introduce yourself as to what you're doing down there in Tasmania, and just let's hear about yourself, Ian.
Okay, good morning, Hugo, and other listeners, other fellow farmers. I've been biologically farming on my present property for 14 years now. The property is geared up for cash cropping. We're growing carrots, onions, potatoes, and we crop the oilseed poppies, or the opium poppies, wheat, and we grow various grass and clover crops for silage production. And we've been strongly influenced by quite a few of the American biological farming speakers that have come through the Australian circuit over the last 12 to 14 years, the likes of Gary Zimmer, Arden Anderson, and Neil Kingsley. And also there's a lot of good Australian speakers out there too that have helped us along the way, and we seem to be having fairly good successes and producing fairly good crops using biological farming methods.
And what was the first thing that had you be aware or start moving or listening to any of these guest speakers? Like, you're farming away, you're quite happy farming, and then something must have happened or some sort of inclination came along or some sort of influence to have you start going down this track, because quite a few farmers haven't even heard the names that you just mentioned.
That's correct, and even till today there's still a lot of people don't know the names of Arden Anderson, Elaine Ingham, these sort of biological farming people. I suppose my greatest concern was the definite increase in the use of chemical herbicides, the increase in chemical fertiliser bills each year. We seem to be putting more and more on, and the results were getting poorer and poorer. And, of course, as fuel prices have increased and everything, of course, the chemical and fertiliser prices increase. So I suppose that was the major driving influence to start with. But through that and listening to the other speakers, we found it very important that we do want to produce a good, edible, nutritional product for the consumer also.
Ian, what was the first step that you made to go away from using the conventional sort of product? And you were using the conventional product then, but what was your first? What was the first point of influence?
Okay, I suppose the initial emphasis has been on one, cutting down chemical use of chemical fertilisers through the replacement with a bit more slower release products. More into the rock phosphate type products. I think the most important stepping stone was really to get our calcium levels up by applying lime and dolomites to get our calcium up to that nice round 65% figure. And also the buffering of some of the knockdown herbicides with fulvic acids and acids to lower the pH of those water solutions so that those knockdown herbicides are more efficient, so we could actually cut back the rate of herbicide that we were using on the farm. And at that time we didn't know that they were doing the damage to the soil microbes that they are actually doing. And by adding the fulvic acid, it sort of buffers that chemical influence against the soil microbes. So I suppose that was really our starting point, was just to concentrate on reducing both the herbicide and fertiliser use.
So did that start because you were working with a consultant, or you went to the Art Manderson course, or where had that start?
Basically through... I suppose my first exposure to it was through the Acres newspaper, which was our eco voice.
That's Acres Australia, is it?
Acres Australia, yep.
Yeah.
And, I just started ringing up about a few different biological products that had been advertised in the Acres paper and starting to use those products. And through the Acres newspaper, we saw ads for a presentation that Gary Zimmer, one of the American biological farming speakers, was coming to Australia in 2000, in the year 2000. And so we put our name down to attend that presentation. And I suppose that was really our inspiration. To the work that he was doing, sort of set us on a fairly good foundation then.
Yeah. So what have been the steps that that you have taken on the farm, and that sort of leads to what you were saying at one stage, that there's quite a bit of interest by other farmers in what you're doing. What were some of the steps that you've taken? Because you can call yourself a biological farmer now, couldn't you?
I think that's really what we're trying to term ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got Arden Anderson, and I mean, your interviews last year with Mark from Beyond Organics, and I think as biological farmers, I think that's where we're heading. We want to go beyond organics, climb up the ladder a bit further, because we are definitely looking at the nutritional value of the food that we produce. We're currently getting tests done on some of our vegetable crops compared to conventionally grown crops, just to see what our mineral levels are in those vegetables. So yeah, we're just trying to get up the ladder a bit further beyond the organic labelling sort of system at the moment.
And more recent, so you have moved up the ladder, and you been invited to talk at various times in Tasmania to a farmer group. So, how's that sort of come about? And what can you give me a bit of a rundown of those the conversations you've had and who's sort of attended?
Okay, we were asked back in last November by one of the farming consulting groups in Tasmania to have some input into a carbon farming workshop that they presented. The speakers were a fairly well-known soil scientist down here in Tasmania, and also they invited four farmers to give a talk on their farming operations and with special emphasis on carbon farming. The main speaker, the soil scientist, had an hour and a half of presentation and presented his PowerPoint presentation and had about four or five questions out of the audience. The other three farmers, all farmers had 15 minutes to do their presentations. The other farmers got up and other three farmers got up and did their presentations and got a reasonable level of questions. I proceeded through my notes and presented my 15-minute talk, but I ended up with about 45 minutes of questions. I said to the young girl that had done all the organising, I said, well, Leanne, there could be two points out of this. Either I'm a very poor presenter and people asked a lot of questions because they couldn't understand what I was talking about, or they were very interested and wanted to know more. And she said, I'm pretty certain it was the latter.
Well, I'm certain it was.
Encouraging.
So what sort of more recent developments or what sort of developments are happening that would indicate that farmers are more interested in this, well, we'll call it natural farming, biological farming, or changing, call it what we like. But, what's any indicators that it's sort of, there's a stronger move in this direction?
Oh, definitely. Following on from that initial talk, we've had contact with several farmers groups, and only as recently as yesterday, we had 30 local beef producers that are part of a discussion group, wanted to learn more about biological farming, and so they attended a two-hour session yesterday that went for 5 hours on my property here. So we went through the basics of, you know, how we got into biological farming, the steps along the way, and then proceeded to have a bit of a field tour and show them some of the work that we're doing with our vegetable crops. And of course it's very applicable. It's the same principles applying into a grazing situation of looking after your soil, cutting down your chemical use, and but basically a lot of my recent work has been done with Soil Food Web International, and they were very interested in that work. So we ran through the actual program of making compost up specifically for compost tea brewing and the application of that to the crops. Comments throughout the day were, you know, it sounds like a lot of work doing this, a lot of organising, a lot of work cleaning equipment. And, you know, us as busy farmers haven't got time to do all that. And I said to one little group of farmers there, and I said, well, you know, but you've got time to spend an hour driving down to the fertiliser works to pick up one-ton bag of urea. I said, you know, why can't you spend that time, you know, putting a compost tea brew together? And so it's just showing them a different way of thinking. That yes, it's just a time management system, but, you know, it can be done if you just replace it with other things that they're doing.
So, when it comes to this thing, what these farmers said, they're too busy. They haven't got time to do it. What are these things that you're doing that they wouldn't be doing?
I suppose a lot of time, you know, a lot of the beef producers down here are fairly intense, so they're treating their beef properties fairly similar to the conventional dairy farms when they're rotational grazing on short rotation. So as soon as the cattle come out of their small block, they'll go in there with, usually with urea, nitrogen fertiliser, just to give them a boost in grass production ready for the next rotation. And I suppose that's really what I was trying to get across to them. The time that they're actually doing that is the time that I would spend spraying out my compost teas and vermicompost teas. Once you've got your composting system into place, we just did the conventional little compost ring about 12 months ago, you know, producing, you know, probably 1 cubic metre of you know, high quality compost. We've only actually utilised half of that ring, half the contents of that compost ring over the last 12 months.
Amazing.
But we've treated something like, you know, 450 hectares with that particular quantity of compost. So,
yeah, let's go through that again, because we don't want listeners, if they're not familiar with that, to... So you made up a compost in a ring. Can you describe the size of the ring? And as you said, you ended up with a cubic metre. But how can you sort of spread that over 400 hectares or that half volume? It sounds extraordinary. I know. I just want you to explain to farmers who aren't familiar with what you just did.
Sure. Okay. So the idea behind compost teas is that you want a very high number and a very diverse number of your microbes, being your bacteria, fungi, protozoans and nematodes. Generally, you might not get into the nematode numbers because of the brewing time. Specifically, we're aiming to produce some compost under aerobic conditions, so that we're doing quite a bit of turning within that first 2 week period. To get the diversity of microbes into that compost, we're putting as many inputs, green and dry inputs, high nitrogen and high carbon inputs into that compost ring. So we're using our cereal stubbles, if we can get barley, triticale, wheat stubbles. We're putting loosened and loosened chaff. We're using wood chips from various locations so that we're getting diversity from those different forests. Then we're using our green manure crops, and we're growing multiple species green manure crops. So we've got legumes and grasses and different species in those crops, and that's going into the compost as a green product. Then we're also balancing up with some rock minerals, granite dusts and rock phosphate products, and then we'll just balance that with a little bit of dry kelp and fish products. So we're trying to get as many different inputs into that compost. So we've got all our ingredients. So we actually form what we call a compost ring, which is just a world mesh ring, about a metre high, and we make it about 1.2 metres in diameter. Now that ring's just clipped together with a couple of D-shackles. So it makes a nice little ring, and we start layering the inputs. We go about 50 mil layers as we're building our compost ring up. We're going dry material, green material, high nitrogen material, and then a peppering of our other rock minerals. And then we go another layer of dry materials, our straws and wood chips, then our green matter. And we build this layer right up to the full height of the ring, and probably a little bit more, because the compost will shrink, or as it loses moisture, it's shrinking over time. Through the construction of this heap, we're keeping plenty of water in there, not so it's running out, but just plenty of water in there just so everything's nice and damp. And you're coming back to the squeeze test so that you can just pick up the compost or the material and you just can't quite squeeze the water out of it. So it doesn't want to be dripping wet, but just nice and damp. So we've made this heap up and you've got to get the right balance of green and dry, and there's different recipes for that. And then we just put a plastic tarp over that just to keep any outside moisture and any heat or sunlight or whatever off the heap. Generally after about 24 hours, we use a compost temperature probe and we're checking that heat, and we don't want any of the heat to get any more than 65 degrees and preferably in that 55 degree to 60 degrees Celsius range in the middle of the heat. So as soon as we hit that 55 to 60 degrees, we unshackle the little D-shackles off the compost ring, and we can actually open up the ring and we relocate next to the heap and refasten it. And then we have the process of actually turning the heap. So we're turning it inside out. So what's actually on the outside of the ring now goes onto the inside, and the warmer material comes onto the outside of the ring. Then it goes through the whole process of monitoring that over the next 24, 36 hours. And as soon as we reach that temperature again, back through the whole process again. So over a 2-week period, we may be looking at 6 to 8 turns, but we want to keep that compost aerated and top quality the whole way through. Then you'll sort of start to notice then that it's longer between the turns, and you'll slowly start to get to that period where the temperature's actually dropping back, and it'll slowly work its way back to the ambient temperature. And by that time, you're actually coming up with a fairly homogeneous, good-smelling, nice-looking chocolate-coloured compost. And so we're trying to really produce a top-quality product to use as the ingredients for our compost tea brewing process.
So then you will brew. So what's your brewing equipment look like, and then how many kilos of that compost do you use per hectare, or because you mentioned 450, you make enough compost there for 450 hectares out of that weld mesh ring, which is just mind-boggling, really.
That's right. So the brewing process is to actually multiply those good numbers that we have in the compost. At present, we're just, you know, taking it slowly and trying to get the system worked out before we have much expense in this operation. So we're just using a 1,000-litre IBC plastic shuttle that, you know, other material comes in onto the farm. But the cleanliness of that shuttle has to be really good. So we get in there first of all, we cut part of the top off, so that we've got good access into the cube, and we get stuck into it with just normal household detergent and scrub the insides out, and then give it a good blast out with one of the high pressure sprayers, so we know that we haven't got any foreign pathogen type anaerobic microbes in the container. Then we position a little aeration pump. So we just want to blow air through the pipework into that plastic tube. We don't want to actually circulate it through a pump, otherwise we're destroying the fungi that we're trying to produce in that system. And we just have a 40mm pipe coming down out of the aerator and running along the bottom of the plastic tube and the pipe running across the floor has a series of holes drilled in it to allow the air to come out evenly and to give us the aeration of the liquid. So into the 1,000 litre cube we can put about 900 litres of water. Into that water, depending what type of tea that you're trying to aim towards, whether it be bacteria dominated, a balanced tea, or a fungal based tea, will determine what ingredients we add to the water as a food for the microbes. So basically we're in a cropping situation, we need to look at a fairly fungal based compost tea. So we're adding about 3 litres of a fish hydrolysate into the water and 1.5 litres of a good quality kelp product. Then we start preparing our compost, and we're putting about 5 kilograms of compost into a compost tea bag. Compost tea bag's probably about 600 mil wide, and about 600 mil wide and about 450 mil deep. This is to give it plenty of surface area as the water bubbles up through it. But we've sort of been inspired a fair bit by the work that David Davison's done with the vermicompost brewing. So we're actually doing a bit of a compromise. We're using about 2.5 kilos of our homemade compost, but we're also using about 2.5 kilograms of vermicompost. So we've got little worm farms going, and we're collecting the vermicompost from those never-fill bin systems and mixing that with our compost that we've produced and putting that into our tea bag. So we're getting a bit more diversity of microbes in our tea that we're brewing. Then we brew that tea for about 18 hours, and we've actually been fortunate enough to attend a microscope course, and the advantage of that is that we can actually test that tea on farm to make certain that we have the right microbes balance and that we haven't actually brewed up any pathogen type microbes. So we then inspect that under the microscope, which only takes us about 10 minutes now to have a look at the tea. Then we can determine whether we want to actually brew for a little bit longer. Generally we have to brew a little bit longer because of our water temperature, and also we are chasing fairly high fungal numbers. So we may brew for another 4, 5, 6 hours until we get that brew just where we need it, and then it's virtually finished, ready to apply to the paddock. Currently we're still in a soil building process with our microbes, so we are still applying around about 100 litres of that compost tea solution per hectare, and mixing that with about 100 litres of water just to give it a bit more coverage onto the soil.
So you've got 900 litres in the tank, and you would do 9 hectares with that tank?
9 hectares with that tank, that's correct.
Right.
So we use about 450 litres of the solution for that original brew into our sprayer unit, which is 900 litres also, and we top it up with water. So it leaves about 450 litres of compost tea in that original brew. So we then, while I'm off spraying the 4.5 hectares, I then top up the brewer with the other 450 litres of water. And it usually takes me about an hour to go out and spray, the 4 or 5 hectares. So I then bubble that brew for another hour while I'm away, and that just helps to repopulate that new water I haven't seen any big differences yet, but it will be interesting over the period of time to see whether there's much difference between the original brew that goes in as a 50-50 mix and the second brew that's actually been brewed for a little bit longer. See whether there's any difference in that. But I just felt that the brew might as well be doing something while I'm off spraying.
It could easily sound to people that it's a lot of work. Now, you farm quite a few hectares there, so what some of the areas you farm as far as your onions, the things that farmers get an idea, the sort of area that you're covering, and that's one question. The next question is, do you find that this, well, not so much you find, but how would you describe to our listeners that it is really, that the work is worthwhile, the time's worthwhile spending in what you're doing?
This particular year we had about 12 hectares of onions planted. We had 8 hectares under a full soil food web growers program where we did a lot of monitoring and a lot of testing throughout that time. We're just in the process of actually doing the harvest on those onions, and to date there's been no big difference as far as the quality or the size of the onions or yield of the onions go. But under the soil food web program, they've had far less chemical fertiliser used, and we actually had 3 less herbicide sprays used on that biologically controlled area. So I suppose while I was out spraying compost teas on the biological area of the onions, on the other foot, I would have been using the tractor to spray herbicides on the conventional area. So as far as timing goes, I have spent about the same amount of time in the tractor. But then I've had considerable savings because I haven't had to spend the money on herbicides. It's costing me around about 20 cents a litre to produce my compost tea. And given the fact the tractor time's still an expense, but it's balanced out by the fact that you would have to be spraying a herbicide instead of a compost tea, we're still way, I've never seen a chemical sold in a 20 litre drum for 20 cents a litre, so we're well out in front cost-wise.
Yeah, so the effort that you are putting into making the compost, and putting it out, you see that's well worth your time?
That's correct, yeah. While the other farmers are running down to the rural merchants to pick up their drum of spray, I'm actually in the process of brewing and making compost. So that's where I save my time, when I'm not running down to the store to pick up the chemical drum.
The other thing too is that you mentioned the microscope, and how important is it for farmers to learn to use a microscope, and how daunting is it? Is it something you'd recommend, or give us a bit of a rundown on how you went about the microscope and why you're using it and its value and whether it's relevance to other farmers.
I definitely think it's very relevant to do that, to understand yourself what you're trying to achieve and do, and you're not sort of relying on other people telling you what's happened. You can physically pick up a drop of that compost tea and put it onto a microscope slide. I think the biggest thing was, I spent one day at a microscope course, and I think the biggest part of the day was really learning how to use a microscope compared to how we used to use them at school. So most of that knowledge is most of that training was just in how do you use a microscope. You don't necessarily need to get into the actual, you know, what sort of bacteria is that, what sort of fungal strand is that. You can usually pick that up as you go along by referring back to the textbook, sort of, as to sort of say, well, you know, they are this sort of bacteria, or this is a, this sort of fungi, or this is that type of protozoa. That's sort of all in the book. So once you start putting a few slides under the microscope and you've learned how to actually focus that all in, it's quite interesting to see how the T's actually change over that, you know, 4 to 6 hour period. And that's where it's crucial. Like if you needed to send that away to a lab, you still have to put your tea out within a set time, but you still don't know whether you've actually achieved the best results for that tea that you've put it achieved. But with a microscope on site, all you really need to do is visualise that, yes, I've got good bacteria numbers in relation to my fungi numbers. Yes, I'm starting to pick up a few little nice flagellant protozoas floating around. I think my tea is ready to put out now. So I think that's really the advantage that we receive. It's not, you know, most farmers, like, I have trouble programming a GPS, but I can use a microscope. So I think if the farmer's got the capabilities of modern technology, he can soon handle the microscope.
So what, it seems like there's basic things, like the soil life and there's a microscope. So one aspect, like the basic thing is very basic. Up to even the way you make a compost seems pretty basic. And then you get to the other end where you're using a microscope. So it sounds a bit quite extraordinary. So do you see that's a part of farming now, marrying the two things together?
Yes, no, it's definitely a balance. You know, you're producing a good compost. You can send that away to a lab because you've got more time to get that tested and find out that you have got a good compost. But when it actually comes to the compost tea brewing process, the numbers seem to change fairly quickly over, you know, a few hours. You can go from either a low numbered tea, with, you know, bacteria dominated, within 3 to 4 hours you can start to swing back into a bit more fungal dominated tea. And it's just knowing that point that it's going to best suit your paddock as to when it's right to put that tea out. And so you'll only pick that up under a microscope on site at that time. And for a lot of disease prevention, you know, we need to get those fungal numbers up in intensive cropping situation. And we've been able to get these onion crops through without the use of any fungicide sprays, where there had been a fairly heavy demand on the use of fungicide sprays on other conventional crops over this last spring-summer period. So it just showed that the attention to detail and producing a good fungal-based compost tea with beneficial fungi in it, we're able to actually suppress the mildew spores.
So I think when I was talking to you one other time, when you were talking to the SFI people, that they said that by monitoring the soil, that you can actually tell if the crop, what the health of the crop's going to be well ahead of any problem situation. So can you sort of explain that a bit to our listeners?
So basically everything's coming out of the soil, so really that's what we're really concentrating on, is to have a good balance in the soil of good physical properties. You still need a good chemistry based to start with, which goes back to good calcium levels, a good ratio with magnesium. You still need your phosphorus. But over the last 2 to 3 years, we've found that the biology side is just as important to keep balanced. Most of our modern farming methods have tended to drift our soils too bacteria-dominated, which, when soils are too bacteria-dominated, seem to encourage the weedy species of broadleaf weeds and grasses, or like low successional grasses, very, very fast-maturing grasses. So by shifting, so every time we cultivate, every time we use a herbicide, every time we use a fungicide, we're actually reducing those soil numbers of soil fungi, so it's increasing the bacteria numbers. So the whole SFI approach has been, let's keep concentrating on the soil balance of bacteria to fungi to keep it at the right ratio to grow that particular crop that you're aiming to grow. And it was quite eye-opening to find that even an operation as simple as a deep ripping operation to break up soil compaction, in our onion patch we had the soil tested by the soil food web lab just prior to that operation, and we had a good balance of bacteria and fungi. We went through with the tined implement, and the next test 2 weeks later showed that we'd actually lost 66% of our fungi numbers just through that one operation. So we virtually had to come straight back in with another compost tea to lift that balance back up again. And by doing that, we came to the right growing conditions for that onion crop. And consequently, it saved us three herbicide sprays, because there was a good fungal base there. So the broadleaf weeds would sort of say, well, you know, this is not the right conditions for us to grow in. You know, we'll just stop on holidays a little bit longer until the conditions change around back into a more bacteria-dominated soil. So basically, the foundation is still your soil, but it's understanding that some of these other operations that we do are interfering with the biology, and now with compost and compost teas, we're actually able to go out there and at least bring that level back up to a balanced ratio again for that particular crop.
So then benefit, just recapping, then benefit, you've got far less weeds, you three less weedicide sprays, and you didn't have to use any fungicides whatsoever because you worked with compost tea. Is that right as a summary?
That's correct. But
it's worth
doing from those points of view. But the other thing too is that you actually increased the nutrient cycling within that, because we actually produced a bigger root system on our crop, so that the root system was able to actually absorb more of the soil nutrient, and we probably had about a 60% saving on actual synthetic fertilizers. I mean, we still use fertilizers on the onions, on the biological side, but we used a composted, pelletized chicken manure pellets on those, where we used a high analysis fertilizer on the conventional block. So we definitely had a big saving on the quantity of fertilizer that we applied to the crop also.
So you actually had a conventional crop running side by side with your biological crop of onions, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So, yeah, we still haven't come up with the final figures, but I would say that the biological side, we're probably going to produce equivalent yield for about two-thirds of the cost of the conventional area.
Right.
By the time you take all your fertiliser and spraying spraying into account.
Ian, you're talking about onion crops and your other crops that you've grown. Now, you made mention that you had a group of farmers, about 30, 40 farmers turn up yesterday, wasn't it?
Yesterday, that's correct.
And they're beef farmers. How were you able to relate to them? What were your messages for them to... And they must have related very well for them to have a two-hour session that went into a five-hour session. So how does your system apply to them? What was their interest in what you had to say?
Well, I suppose we're still looking at a plant-based system, whether it's perennial pasture or a cropping situation. We're still looking at a plant growing in a soil. And I suppose the approach of all this balancing is, feed the soil and that'll feed the plant. And so really the approach was, quite simple for them to follow is that, fair enough, I may have to work my soil a little bit more to get a crop established. That they have the benefits of not knocking their soil biology around quite as much because they're permanently grazing. So they took to the concept quite easily, and then we actually got into the actual process of how the system could help them in the fact that you've got that increased nutrient cycling, you're then going to be able to, the microbes will then start to work in the soil structure to get bigger and better root development. So they'll be accessing more nutrient, and plus then the crop has the ability, or the grass has the ability then to survive through the summer period in, with some growth, so it's not so reliant on irrigation or what have you to grow their grass crops for their beef production.
You said these farmers wouldn't, if they went followed your process, they wouldn't have to use synthetic nitrogen?
Because a lot of these beef guys are looking at high production and they're following the dairy farmers' program, that's why they're using nitrogen to grow their grass. But when you see the benefits of compost and compost teas, and this has been emphasised very well by Camperdown Compost and Tony and Nick with their group of dairy farmers, is that they've been able to cut out their nitrogen applications by getting a better soil microbial life. As soon as this was explained to these beef guys, they definitely could see the benefits of increasing, because they've been trying to grow their beef just using ryegrass. A lot of them have gone away from mixing clovers into their grass mixes. They've just been chasing that high dry matter content from high yielding producing ryegrasses. So now they're starting to see that, yes, they need to keep a few more legumes in their pasture. They need to start looking at their microbes, either through application of compost or compost teas, and then gradually start to wean themselves back off the use of artificial nitrogen fertilisers.
And they're not likely to go backwards while they're doing that sort of thing?
No, you've still got the buffering, well, not the buffering, but I mean, I think Tony got his group of dairy farmers to go away from dry urea type fertilisers into liquids.
Right.
So number one, you had the savings to start with in that you didn't get that volatilisation of your urea as soon as you put it out there. You got better utilisation of the product that you sprayed out there. And that was just your safety net to sort of keep that production running. So no one wants to take the step backwards.
No, we understand.
We still need to move forward all the time, but just in a bit more organised way.
Yeah, and I just want to make a message. We've got quite a few farmers online, and I just want to let a few farmers know that if you want to say anything, just start talking, and we will stop talking and listen to what you've got to say. So there we are. See, and we'll just keep talking until someone asks a question.
Okay, sure. The other work that we're doing, which you sort of alluded to in your leaflet, was that we were successful in putting an application together for some funding as part of the Caring for Our Country money that the federal government put out. And we've actually received $10,000 to do a 2-year study on some of our vegetable crops, and we chose to do our potatoes. And that money will help pay for a lot of the test results and you know, keeping a handle on what we're doing. So we've actually, to keep it unbiased as much as we could, we actually asked one of our local potato growers to come in and actually do the planting of whole crop, but to actually plant his crop as a conventional crop the way he would normally plant on his own property. So we set up six replica little trials. They're both about, they're only about a third of a hectare each. So that gives us about a hectare of biologically grown potatoes and a hectare of conventionally grown potatoes. And we're comparing those side by side. And that work's been monitored by Dr. Mary Cole down at the AgPath Labs in Gippsland. And as we walked through the field yesterday, and this group of beef producers sort of looked at the potatoes and said, we can't see any difference. We can see your little pegs, but we can't see any difference. And my comment was, oh, that's good. And they all looked at me as if to say, well, you know, why isn't one better than the other? And my approach was, we've used far less fertiliser, we've used far less herbicides, we've used no fungicides at all on our biological patch. And if they're still looking as good as the conventional, why would you want to spend all the extra money on the conventionals? So then we proceeded to actually, we grabbed the fork and we forked a plant out from each of the little trial groups, and the potato tubers are just starting to form. But there was actually more numbers and a more uniform potato tuber on the biological block than the conventional. So that was very, very eye-opening. And this is going to be a 2-year study, so what we learn in biological methods over this current season can actually be enhanced and improved on in the second year of the crop. So it should turn out to be a very informative study.
So, Dr. Mary Cole, you might explain your relationship there and who she is, and well, I know who she is, but to explain to the listeners who she is, where she fits in with your concern.
Okay.
Because you'll be hearing more of the lady.
Yep. So after a very successful Farming Secrets luncheon out at Tukey Farm, one weekend, I came back home and did some farm work, and then it was back to Melbourne the next weekend. And Dr. Mary Cole actually held a 3-day soil food web course. So I just wanted to polish up on a few of my microscope skills and everything, so I went along to the course and mentioned that we'd applied for this funding for the grant for the potato trial, and yes, she was very keen to be involved in the actual testing, and she's virtually an accredited soil food web international lab. And she's been accredited by Dr. Elaine Ingham. And also, Stuart Proud and Darren Morgan worked very closely with her, and their guys actually out in the field really working hard on all this biological approach. So by working with Dr. Mary Cole, we're actually able to access into their knowledge and help us apply that to this potato trial. So it's through that exchange of information between ourselves and Dr. Mary Cole and Stuart and Darren. But yeah, we've come up with quite a successful program on this potato patch at the moment, so we're looking forward to the final results.
Well, it's promising, isn't it? We can say there's more tubers, more evenly sized, and less cost. It's
less cost, and the most important thing, what we're trying to achieve, is in this field of processing potatoes, they have a figure that they call the solids content, and it's actually the higher the solids content, it increases the storing ability of the potato, which is very important in a processing situation because they need their potatoes to go through their factory all year round to keep a uniform production. A lot of the conventionally grown potato crops are very low in the solids level. And there's even some crops that actually have to be processed within days of being lifted out of the paddock. So we're sort of hoping, and the work Dr. Elaine Ingham's done in America is virtually indicating that under a more natural biological approach, we're using far less nitrogen, and thus this is attributing to this higher solids level. And if we can increase the storage ability, hopefully that also in future years will reflect back into hopefully a better price for the crop itself. So that's important.
Yeah, well, that's the manufacturing side, but when it comes to the consumer, if you're selling directly to consumers, hopefully the consumers could taste the difference and appreciate the difference.
As a fresh
potato rather than made into some processed thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, Ian, this has been quite a long journey for you to start with Gary Zimmer, was it, back in 2000?
Gary Zimmer back in 2000.
And now it's 11, 12 years later that, if you've been at it now for a couple of years, you're sort of well into the biological side. So has it been worthwhile for you? Are you more stressed or less stressed now that you've taken this approach? And are you sort of overtaxing yourself mentally by taking this approach? Or what would you say to other farmers about your journey?
There's definitely a lot of shortcuts that people are coming in to this approach today can sort of shorten 12 years worth of work up into probably 5 or 6 years. But it still takes time to change that soil biology, to get the soil chemistry working, and this so-called conventional farming, or I don't really know how the word conventional came up, because it's only been the last 50, 60 years that the chemical industry's really taken off, but it's taken that 50 or 60 years to bring our farms down to this level. It's very hard to switch it around in 2 or 3 years, and we were told initially by Dr. Arden Anderson that a 5 or 6 year program is usually what it takes. And I still think that's not too far off the money by the time you start addressing your soil chemistry levels, your calcium levels, that sort of thing, and then start working on your biology to really get it to that nice, comfortable level. We're still looking at a few years, but if you don't start this year and you leave it for 3 or 4 years, you're still 3 or 4 years behind those people that start today.
It is worthwhile to go down the track. I'm talking about, it's worthwhile for you, but what about other farmers when they're faced with what you're faced with,
what you have faced? When I did my first initial talk, it was to do with soil carbon and carbon farming, and we have to have a look at our carbon footprint. And under this system, where you can produce your compost on farm, you can have your worm farms running, you can produce your own compost tea, you're cutting down the use of your artificial fertilizers and your chemical herbicides, they're only going to get dearer. As this carbon tax comes into force, you've got the cost of manufacturing those fertilizers and chemicals, you've got the cost of trucking those to the farm. It's all going to be carbon taxed, even though farmers are exempt, but we still have to pay those particular costs for our inputs. But under this farming system, we can do a lot on farm. I'm not saying that we can do away with all inputs at this stage, but at least we can cut a lot of those input costs down. Our soils are looser. We're in the process of harvesting these onions at the moment, and when you get the tractor driver that drives the tractor, and I mean he's doing all the harvesting on all the onion fields, and he hops out of the tractor and says, "You know, why is your ground so soft?" For a tractor operator to notice that sort of...
So he's an operator goes to other farms, is he?
He's operating on all farms all around the district. And he hops out of his tractor and puts his foot onto my soil and says, "Why is your ground so soft?" It's the biology that's in there. It's the calcium-magnesium ratio. It's all that biological work that's gone on. The soil's just like a sponge. You can just press it and it springs back up again. Well, that reduces our requirements for, you know, heavy tillage work because our ground breaks up easy. We use less fuel. We're wearing out less tractors. So this is all the important little messages along the way that we have to look at reducing that carbon, our carbon footprint on each of these farms. And I think that's probably, in today's terms, is going to be one of the most important parts of what we're doing with biological farming.
Yeah, Ian, I just picked up my ears to what you said, less wear and tear on the tractors, because broadacre farmers who farm thousands of acres, if they can reduce their wear and tear on their tractor or whatever, that could be a big thing for them. But I think the main thing is what you're sort of saying is that you get the soil nice and soft, the soil starts functioning better.
Yeah. Well, in our latest GRDC publication, the grain research people, there was a big farmer in Western Australia, and they wrote him up as, you know, we do 5,000 hectares of wheat crop. You know, we've got big gear and everything. But, you know, we use 850,000 litres of diesel a year.
850,000
litres of diesel a year for 5,000 hectares. Now, I don't know what the yields are up there, but I'd have to put it to you, the vegetable crops that I'm growing here now, I think I'm probably feeding more people, and I use 8,000 litres a year. So this is where carbon farming is going to sort all this out within the next couple of decades. Now, these guys just won't be able to afford to a farm on those real big broad acres under their conventional systems. And that's just his diesel input. What's his fertiliser carbon footprint?
And his finance.
What's his herbicide input?
Mm.
Not saying, you know, I'm not knocking broadacre farming. It's just that, you know, they need to probably have a look, you know, at their total farming system.
Ian, we've run out of time, or it's about time that we'd like to stop this interview, so I would like to thank you very, very much for coming online, and most importantly, like to thank all the farmers who have come online, and like to thank the farmers who are going to be listening to this, and I just know that what you've had to say is paramount, because moving towards the biological way of farming it has a lot of merit. So, Ian, would you like to sum up those two, do a bit of a sum up on yourself and your own farm operations?
Okay, yeah, well, Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk to other farmers and yourself today, Hugo.
Pleasure.
I have no regrets in going down the biological farming path. It has been a hard, slow path because you were virtually at the leading edge to a lot of the work that the Americans had done hadn't been applied in Australian conditions. So we had hurdles to overcome during that process. But definitely see the results on all our crops, and the fact that we are reducing costs now and see the result in our better quality and better flavour of our vegetables. So, thank you, Hugo.
Thank you very much. And how do you feel yourself in terms of, do you feel like it's a good thing what you're doing? Is it worth your while? What's your own your feelings about yourself?
You definitely look forward to each day. And when you sort of go into a conventional field that's been sprayed with herbicide and fungicides, you can actually smell the spray in those fields now. After not having used them myself, I'll go into another farmer's field and smell those smells, and I can't say it's doing any of us any good.
Anyway, you're much happier. Would you say you are leading a more satisfied farming life now that you've sort of taken all these steps over the last 14 odd years?
Yep. No, I definitely think it's definitely a healthy way to farm.
That's the way to go. Ian, I'll thank you very, very much. Thank all the listeners who are on the line, and we will. We didn't have any questions, so that doesn't. Well, we will answer other questions if people ring in. So, Ian, it's goodbye from me, and
goodbye from him.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
Okay, thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.